Hello, you're listening to a Melbourne Writers Festival podcast recorded at MWF Digital in 2020.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for joining us for this rather strange but also very exciting iteration, I suppose, of the Melbourne Writers Festival. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge that while, you know, we are in the digital space and this video will be accessible from a lot of places, we are putting it together and the festival itself is largely put together in the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri and Boonwurrung peoples of the Kulin Nations. And I'd like to pay my respects to the elders past, present and emerging. This continent we're on has a 40,000 year history of storytelling. And on one hand, we're very privileged to be continuing that, particularly, you know, in this form where we're engaging in and talking about literature and storytelling. But on the other hand, it's also worth acknowledging that sovereignty was never ceded and the repercussions and reverberations of colonial violence continue to this day. So hello again. My name is Adolfo Ranwiz. I am a writer, editor, and dancer, and obviously speaker, as you can see right now. We are doing this thing called MWF Digital, Melbourne Writers Festival Digital. And so if you would like to join in, as is typical of the digital space, you can do so by using the hashtag #MWFDigital. I'm very excited to be joined by the author of a novel that I've just inhaled over a series of days because I couldn't put it down, How We Disappeared, Jing Lee. Thank you for joining me, Jing.
Hi, Adolfo. Thank you for having me.
So I'm just going to give everyone a little rundown if they don't know who you are. I don't know why they wouldn't, but they should if they don't. Jing Lee was born and raised in Singapore, and How He Disappeared is her first novel. It was published by One World in 2019 and has been longlisted for the Women's Prize as well as the Walter Scott Prize for historical fiction. Jing has a master's in creative writing from the University of Oxford and currently lives in sunny Amsterdam, well, sunny right now because it's summer, with her husband and son. So yes, how are you feeling? What is it like over there in summer?
Well, it's a bit of a strange summer because, you know, as you know, the pandemic has affected everything.
Yes.
It was a very slow start to the summer because people haven't been going away. But as the pandemic kind of wore off a little bit, you know, in this country at least, I know it's terrible elsewhere, people have started to leave for summer vacation. So it's strangely quiet when, you know, I think just a few weeks ago, it was filled with children with nowhere to go. Now they're all gone.
Wow.
But it's weather, it's not too hot. As you can see, the lighting is perfect for me.
The lighting is incredible, unlike my very kind of gloomy wintry house. So yeah, as I said, I did inhale your book and I couldn't put it down. I really enjoyed it. So for those who haven't heard of it before, and hopefully, if you haven't picked it up yet, then you do so after this riveting conversation that we're about to have. It's a really revelatory, artfully composed, I suppose, meditation on the horrors of war and trauma, silence, and I suppose gendered and cultural self-effacement. It's about this woman, Wang Di, who lived through the harrowing experience of being a comfort woman at the hands of the Japanese when Singapore was occupied during the Second World War. I'll leave it there for now. Let's let it unfold as we have the conversation. But I suppose to begin with, Jing, what compelled you to recount, or I guess reimagine, you know, this topic, the experiences of a comfort woman during the Second World War?
To be honest, I didn't go into it thinking, you know, I'm going to write a novel set in World War II. I'm going to write about comfort women. I wrote this novel because I had this short story collection before, and there were several characters in it. All of these characters were living in this one apartment building that was slated to be torn down, and one of them was an elderly woman called, I called then, just Cardboard Lady, because her occupation was just, her means of living was to pick up scrap cardboard and recycle it for a bit of money. And She, after the book, she lingered on in my mind and I couldn't stop thinking about her. And I started to dream about her. So I decided I would write about her. And the book, well, the first few drafts came in a rush because I think I wrote about 30,000 words in just a few weeks, which is quite a lot for me. And then I decided, okay, since I seem to have the material, that I would work on a novel. So that's what I did. And it turned out that I didn't think about it, how it would look then, but it turned out that there would be a lot of research involved. Yes. And that would very much set in Japanese occupied Singapore.
How did you, I mean, you mentioned that you ended up, you know, dreaming about this character like almost obsessively, but when, you know, that gap between a concept and really putting it down would have involved, as you said, a lot of research. How did you go about doing that? Like the scope of this story, once people have read it, it's quite expansive, really.
Yeah, I mean, I exploited every medium that I could possibly. It was a little bit difficult because I was based first in Germany and then in the Netherlands. So I wasn't living in Singapore. I didn't have always the access to archive material. Thankfully, a lot of the war archives from Singapore is online. Although I did visit the archives a few times when I was in Singapore for a visit. And so it was a lot of online material, archival material online, as well as audio interviews. From both a Singaporean source as well as British sources. There are also a lot of testimonies from former comfort women, Korean comfort women especially, because you have heard a lot about how they've been fighting for recognition. And so a lot of the testimonies and interviews are online as well. There are also documentaries about this. One of the best was made actually by a Dutch documentarian, and it's called Omdat we mooi zijn, which translates into because we are beautiful. And it interviews, I think, mostly Indonesian women who were also taken when they were occupied by the Japanese. Yeah.
It was quite a large tract of land that they, you know, occupied, the Japanese, I mean. Like, they really moved down from China down to Indochina through what was then British Malaya to, yeah, the island of Singapore. And as you've beautifully captured in the novel, the people of Singapore really didn't expect that to happen. You know, they were under this impression that the British would protect them. But I guess it would have been a surprise when it finally happened.
Yeah, they had to believe, and it was reiterated a lot that their fortress was impenetrable, and they didn't think that, well, they didn't think that the Japanese would skirt around. And what was obvious was that their cannons were pointed this way when the Japanese troops were, you know, going the other way around. And it was just, it was unexpected because, of course, during war, there's a lot of propaganda, and there's propaganda from all sides, of course, and the British were determined that they would be able to fend off the Japanese, which involves a little bit of racism as well, because they thought as people with, you know, that perhaps they thought they had superior equipment, superior skills, so they thought it would not be a big deal. So when they did lose Singapore, I think Churchill was reportedly devastated. But of course, Singaporeans, people who lived on the island, bore the brunt of it.
Yeah. I feel this is the perfect time to maybe tease our audience with a bit of a reading from you. Would you like to give us a bit of a short reading for now from the novel?
I'd like to read just from the first two pages of the book, which I think gives a very good idea of what Wang Di is like and what the rest of the book might be like. So this is from the perspective of the main character, Wang Di. She began in the first month of the lunar year. They said she was born at night, the worst time to arrive. Used up all the oil in the lamp so that her father had to go next door for candles. It took hours, and was only after muddy up swaths of moth-eaten sheets the neighbors had given in the last few weeks for mother's pregnancy that she emerged. As the first whales crept through the hot end of the top hut, he went into the bedroom to look at her, a worm of a thing freshly pulled out of the earth. When he saw the gap between the baby's legs, the first time father spat, then slumped in a chair at the kitchen table, eyeing his wife as she nursed, already thinking about the next child. That is one story. Or, she began when her mother found her in a rubbish skip. She was walking to the market with four eggs her hands late that morning, was passing by the public bins when it started to whimper. The woman looked in and there she was, a child, scraps of leftover dinner on top of it. She took the baby home and brushed the dirt off her face, waited for a week to see if anyone would come and claim her. They kept her when no one did. Third and last story, told to the child by her aunt, was that she was born and her father took her to the pond, the one where water spinach grew. Villagers went to collect it in armfuls when they could afford nothing else for dinner. And it was by this vegetable, completely hollow in the middle of the stems as to warrant the name Kunsin, empty heart, that her father put her. The aunt told the story each time she went to visit, and each time, as she got to this point in the story of her niece's birth, she would stop, smack her lips and lean in close, and adding that her father had tried to push her under with the tip of his sandaled foot. She explained that it wasn't easy what he was doing because the water was shallow and the weeds were holding her up. "You're bobbing in and out of the water," she said, "and the whole business was almost finished with when you stopped crying from the feeling of damp on your body and simply looked at him. Your eyes opened up a crack and you just stared into his face." The aunt couldn't say why, but it made the new father take the child back home again. He put the bundle on the table like a packet of biscuits and told his wife she could keep her if she gave birth to a baby born next year. They didn't bother naming the girl for a few weeks, but when they did, they named her Wang Di, the hoped-for brother.
So beautiful. I realize I probably should have mentioned this earlier on for the audience that a bit of a content warning that we will be discussing quite heavy stuff in this conversation. And also it's in the novel too, around sexual abuse, of course, gendered violence, war and death and murder. But yes, so thank you for that beautiful reading. I guess immediately branching off from that, I may as well ask. So the novel doesn't just tell the story of Wang Di from that straight 1940s period. You've used this quite intelligent, like trifurcated structure where you have, we'll talk about the secret third one after, but the two main ones are not just, Wang Di from the 1940s, but also Wang Di from the 2000s, from, now that she's in her 70s. Why did you choose to adopt those two perspectives?
Well, I wanted to bring Wang Di closer to the modern day audience because to see her in the year 2000-ish would be to see the after effects of, what war does to a person. And it's not just the immediate after effects, like physical injury, starvation, malnutrition, but it's also the accumulated years of not having talked about trauma, of not having been able to process psychological injury as well. I think that says a lot. And to set it in modern-day Singapore would also be to contrast her as an elderly, out of date, out of time, a bit of out of place, as well, see what a woman like that, how she fits into contemporary society.
And so it's actually really interesting. You were talking earlier about the cardboard lady that you were obsessing about in your short story. And, you know, in this novel, that is Wang Di. Wang Di is a cardboard lady. Not that she would, you know, adopt that label for herself. Obviously, it's a label that's kind of almost obsessively imposed on her by, you know, people looking at her. Could you tell us more about that kind of label of cardboard lady, if it's not too much of a spoiler?
No, it's not a spoiler at all. You see these elderly people in Singapore who are hovering just below the poverty line, who pick up cardboard as a means of living, because at the age of around 70, they don't really do the jobs that they used to be able to do, more manual jobs, where if you have been to Singapore, you will be able to see elderly people cleaning up tables at hawker centers, things that, you know, they shouldn't have to do anymore. But once they lose the jobs that they used to have, they resort to picking up cardboard for recycling just to get a bit of money to pay rent, afford groceries. And they are not really well taken care of, because I think some of them qualify for welfare, but it's just not enough. Or they find it offensive to be on welfare. Different reasons, but whatever it is, the money's just not enough. So you see quite a few of these elderly people resorting to, yeah, picking up cardboard for a living.
Yeah. The interesting thing for me, because I think when I was going through, I didn't know this, you know, I was born and grew up in Manila, and a lot of the, and my mother is Hokkien, so a lot of the elements from the story were quite familiar to me because Wang Di is of Hokkien descent, but, and you weave in these beautiful scenes about Kang Kong, the water spinach, which I love and miss dearly because I can't find them here in Melbourne. But this aspect, no, I mean, I'm sure they're around. I'm just not looking hard enough. I don't think they grow natively here. I think it's a very like strongly tropical plant. But yeah, that aspect of the story, the cardboard lady thing, the collection of you know, scrap, I didn't quite understand until you know, explained it in that way. But the other thing about her collection of scrap and other kind of miscellanea, and correct me if I'm wrong, I did read it also, you know, this hoarding behavior as part of her attempts to make sense of her trauma. So kind of like collecting discarded objects because she felt in some way that she was worthless after what she'd gone through. Would that be accurate?
Well, there's several reasons. I think this one is a bit of a spoiler. Because of what happens during her time in the comfort house, she picks up this habit of collecting items and not letting things go. But as you say, it's also a way of processing trauma, of trying to make sense of what happened by having reminders, visual, physical objects around her so that she feels safe. I do also have to say that I took this bit, this, you know, hoarding from a grand aunt who was also, who had bad experiences during the war, and she ended up being a hoarder as well, right into her old age. So it wasn't completely original. I didn't know her very well because when I was young, she was already quite old. But I do remember the fact that her apartment was just filled with stuff. You couldn't walk. I mean, it was just impossible to walk around, and there was nowhere to sit. So I got that from her, yeah.
Oh, I wish I could talk more about this, but I really don't want to spoil it for people. But I will talk to you about it afterwards and see if I was right about my reading of this. But yeah, like trauma, clearly, and you know, processing trauma and growing from trauma is definitely a strong aspect, possibly the strongest aspect of your novel. And I have to credit a friend, Leah McIntosh, for recommending me this book. But Lucy Bond and Steph Krapps, in their book titled Trauma, talk about how, on the one hand, of course, trauma is quite prominent in contemporary literature as a topic, you know, depictions of it or discussions of it, whether nonfiction or fiction. But in fiction especially, they've examined this kind of tendency for fiction dealing with trauma to adopt the kind of fragmented psychical states or cognitive states of people with trauma. So instead of the kind of linear ways of storytelling that we're used to, these stories about trauma can't not avoid or can't not adopt, this kind of bleeding of past into present, or, you know, like moments of in the present having weird visions of the future. And this is definitely something that we see in the novel quite strongly, with Wang Di having nightmares, you know, typical of someone with post-traumatic stress disorder and things like that. Was this deliberate on your part to kind of really get at this mindset of someone who's lived through trauma? And if so, like how did you go about perfecting that very sensitive depiction?
I think I extrapolated from my own experiences as well. I've had childhood trauma, which returned to haunt me in my 20s. And it did come back to me in sort of movie-like flashbacks. And the thing about when you try to repress memories is the harder you try to repress them, the harder they hit you when they come back. And you can be successful for a few years and you get by, but the trauma lives inside you. It's like an illness that's just waiting. It's biding its time. And I took it from my own experiences, I think you can kind of visualize how memories like that come back. And it's not always a wash of memories. It comes back in bits and pieces. It's not always, the memories are not always clear, but come back to you in dreams, come back to you in sudden flashbacks when you see an image that reminds you of what happened before, for example, which is how people get really traumatized, of course, and especially rape victims are sensitive to visual images of sexual violence on TV, which is why there are warnings nowadays, which is great. Before scenes like that are depicted on TV. So I do think that I've tried to replicate that experience by fragmenting these visuals and parsing it out, because I don't think it's possible to experience the whole wash of memory all at once. It would just be too much, rather than rather than having the reader go through these memories all at once, I thought the flashing back would also remind the reader that this is an old lady, this is what she's going through, and this is how she's trying to get back to her trauma, even though she doesn't want to.
And you beautifully captured that too in the scenes with her husband, Sun Wei, where, you know, she's clearly... there's clearly affection between them, but she has this difficulty being intimate with him because, of course, of, you know, the memories of being touched by men in a way that she didn't want, you know, in a destructive way. But I might just pivot quickly to that secret third perspective that I brought up earlier. So on top of Wang Di from the 1940s and Wang Di in the present, or sorry, the relative present, the 2000s, you have this other character, Kevin. So he's 12, he's from Singapore. It's in his voice, which I quite enjoyed. And for me especially, I was quite drawn to the way it almost appropriated elements of the mystery genre in his sections, where you really just wanted to know what the hell he was piecing together. There were clues, the pacing was much quicker. Why insert Kevin? You know, a child, an outsider to the war experience. Why did you choose to do that?
Well, to be very honest, it was partially for my own sanity, because you write an entire book about Kung Fu Women and about this kind of trauma in such detail, and such book in World War II, was just a lot for me. And to put Kevin in was to give myself a breather as well. And I thought it was useful for the reader to see Singapore from, you know, a child's perspective, modern day Singapore. This is what it's like. This is how the whole world sees Singapore now. It's gleaming, shiny, it's clean. People are put under pressure at school, and he's a bit of a outcast, and he doesn't know quite what to do with himself. And then he lands on something that he thinks might give meaning to his life. And to a 12-year-old, that's intense. And I wanted people to be able to see Singapore through his eyes, as well as Wang Di's eyes, so as to give the experience of the war its own place as well.
Definitely. I think at this stage, would you be okay to do another reading for our audience?
Yeah, and very good timing, because then I will read a bit from Kevin. So this section is from Kevin's perspective, and it's a few days after his grandmother's funeral. And so just to summarize quickly, before his grandmother died, she accidentally told Kevin a secret. And Kevin's trying to, like you said, find out what happened. I wanted to tell my mother that my father had gone again. Disappeared like the last time he went to his dark place. Except this time, the growing oil was literal. Because instead of having to sit at home two-finger typing out his resume and making phone calls and surfing ads in the newspaper, he had a reason to be out. It was work. Even though sometimes he came home smelling of beer and sweat, as if he had dipped himself in a vat of tiger and walked home, I thought it would be safer to ask my mom first, just in case I went to him and the whole thing went kaboom. My last attempt had gone like this. Ma, don't you think Pa is behaving strangely? What do you mean? Statement, not a question. He's like, you know. She made a rolling gesture with her hands that meant keep going, which I hated. I mean, he's not talking much, and he's not home, and he smells of tiger beer when he comes back. Aiya, 小孩子, she said, little child. Your father is just spending a bit more time at work. Anyway, these are adult issues. Don't bother yourself with them. Is it about Ama? I asked. Even I knew it was, of course. Of course. Because if it is, I can help. Is it about Ama? And do you think I should ask him? Don't ask so many questions. She frowned at me and went back to her files and papers, all spread out on the kitchen table like a collage. So that was that. I tried to go to sleep, but the smell of tackle powder, heavy and floral, stayed in my nostrils. I couldn't help but think that any minute now, Ama will walk through the living room, tracking powder into the kitchen. She will make herself a snack, a smear of margarine on white bread, a cup of hot Milo, just a bit to eat, Shelley said, pinching the air of her thumb and forefinger to show just how much. Tampo, tampo. Just a little, she whispered under her breath. I imagined her sitting in a chair, facing away from the dining table as if she wanted to be able to get out and run any moment. She had important things to do and places to go. I had important things to do and maybe places to go. I got off bed and found an unused notebook in my desk drawer. Then I put the words I had transcribed onto the first page. When I was done, I looked at what I had written and underlined the ones I thought important. I found you. They were dead, or nowhere to be found. I didn't know. I wanted to look for them after the war. But I really didn't want you to blame me when you find out. Please forgive me. I double underlined the word "or" in the second line, then triple underlined it. On the facing page, I wrote down the questions I needed answers to. Where did she find him? Where was my father left when he was a baby? 2. Who are my father's real parents? Are they still alive? Where are they? 3. Ama thinks or knows my father will find out. How does she think this will happen? These were the first questions I needed answers to. I shut my notebook and watched the curtains shift in the breeze until I fell asleep. When I opened my eyes, it was the sound of fingers scrabbling on wood. The room was dark, the light scanty through the drapes, but it was her I saw, and it was she was herself again. mouth and cupid, face off of hair off her face and wound into a bun at the back of her head. The drawers in her dresser were all yanked open, and she was kneeling in front of it, surrounded by pools of fabric. She said something under her breath, like a little curse, and reached her right arm, good and mobile again, all the way into one drawer, extracting it to throw a plastic bag, then a crumpled tissue onto the floor. I rubbed my eyes and asked what she was looking for, if she wanted some help. She didn't reply, just looked in my direction and sighed as if I ought to know, as if I were foolish not to. I called out again, and she told me to hush, to go back to sleep. Then she reached her other arm in the drawer, then her head. Soon, she was in all the way to her torso, her waist. I blinked, and she was gone. For a second, I saw the bottoms of her powdered white feet, her heels, cracked and pale, and the tips of her toes pointed out like a swimmer fighting forward. And then she was gone, like Alice falling down a rabbit hole. She left nothing behind, just a sound in my head, like a smothered shout.
Ah, oh, so wonderful. This actually leads beautifully, your chosen scene beautifully leads into my question. There are a lot of women in your novel. Apart from Wang Di, we have Ama, we have Kevin's mother, a few teachers, you know, the woman from, I suppose the madam would be the term, from the brothel. But yeah, I suppose this experience of women is foregrounded in your novel so significantly. So marriage, motherhood, those sorts of things. But at the same time, you've also perfectly chronicled the inferior status of women in this very patriarchal society, where, you know, even Wang Di being born, you know, she was named specifically to long for a brother because they didn't want her. And the experience of the Comfort House in particular drilled into her that she was worth nothing more than, you know, being a tool for men in this society. Could you tell us more about this kind of patriarchal dynamic, both in the world of the story and in Singapore society generally?
Yeah, unfortunately, this has a very personal basis because Wang Di's name is very similar to my mother's name. My mother's name is Zhao Di, which is to take care of a brother. And she was, I think, the third in line of female children. And they were hoping desperately for a boy. So they named my mother Zhao Di, which is a very traditional name. It's quite common in those days. When you're hoping for a son instead of a daughter. And when you get a daughter, you name your daughter something to do with, you know, male children. And my mother ended up being the carer of her little brothers. And so in a way, her life was sacrificed for her brothers because she had to take care of them. She was yanked out of school and she was kind of the guardian to my uncles. This is not an unusual story in Singapore, I think. And you find that, as with one of my aunts, when there are too many children, the one you give away is always a girl. So this kind of informed my childhood as well. I grew up thinking and hearing a lot from my relatives that my father had hoped for a boy and instead they got me. So I grew up knowing that this is what it was like. Men were always better and women were just, you know, kind of the leftovers. And this informed my choices for this novel very heavily because, of course, most of the historical bits have to do with how women were subjugated and how they were sacrificed for the pleasure of men, for the lives of men in some cases. And the way Wang Di, immediately after her time at the Comfort House, the place where Japanese men visited, captive women. Immediately after her time there, she came out of it thinking that she had been irrevocably damaged, and that she was no good anymore, and she had to be away from her parents. And she finds a way of kind of putting herself back into the family by leaving the family, sort of. So by marrying somebody else who was sort of open to the fact that she was already damaged, because in her case, she was marrying a much older person, blind, and blind matchmaking. So that was kind of part of her sacrifice as well, to marry herself out of the family so that her family would not be tainted by her presence anymore.
You brought up family, and that's another key element in the story, both in terms of Wang Di's journey to, I suppose, self-healing, but on the other hand, it was significantly part of her own sort of self-sabotage as well, in that you brought up earlier shame as well. You've been talking about sacrifice, and these are key things that I've seen as well from my own family, my mom's Chinese background, whereby you really put the family forward, you put yourself last, you put your own pain last. And in this context, the family, from the way I took the development of the storyline, were more concerned about people's perceptions of their family and their standing rather than necessarily helping Wang Di to heal from her experience. And silence was a key part of that. They just didn't talk about it. What was the role of silence in this story?
Yeah, I think it still counts to this day. Social taboo surrounding rape in Asian societies is still very, very strong. And especially in those days, after the war, you could not talk about it. Because if you revealed that you had been taken by the Japanese, or you, you don't even have to be taken by them. The Japanese raped women kind of in situ, in their homes, whatever. If that was revealed and people knew about it and people talked about it, you were done for. You would not have a future ahead of you. And I read about this a lot in testimonies of former comfort women. A lot of them were really afraid of returning to their hometowns because it would be crystal clear to everybody that they had been taken away and used by the Japanese Imperial Army. And to return would be to kind of douse their entire family in shame, and not just themselves. And it might have meant death for some of them. It certainly would have meant ostracization, and that would have been incredibly painful for everybody involved. So some of these women just did not return. Korean women, especially, who were taken from villages in Korea, they stayed in Manchuria, in parts of China where they had been, transported to, because they just wanted to spare themselves the shame as well.
One of the motifs that I noticed throughout reading your book was that of ghosts. So a lot of bad stuff happened in the month of August, which, we of Chinese descent know as Ghost Month. And Kevin constantly thinks that his ama is visiting him, or leaving him little hints in ghost form, obviously. And for me, this idea of ghosts or haunting very strongly relates to the title of the book itself, like disappearing. In a key scene in the comfort house, Wang Di talks about how after everything she's experienced there, and with no real hope of being able to get out, she says, and I quote, "I finally learned what it was like to disappear and still be, that it was possible to disappear and still be there," which to me is quintessentially the definition of a ghost. You're both here and not here. Did you seek out to deliberately kind of infuse this ghost aspect into the story?
I mean, like you said, the idea of disappearing and the idea of silencing this ghost, it's a kind of death in a sense. it's to force these women into not talking about the trauma and to not talking about what happened to them is like enforcing a kind of death, because it's a part of their lives they would never be able to forget or, you know, wash away, no matter how hard they try. So in doing so, these women are also disappearing themselves and trying not to be noticed. In one of the chapters, after Wang Di's release from the comfort house, she's asked, you know, where were you? Where have you been? By her neighbors, you know, people who kind of know, but they're not certain, and well, a little bit kind of afraid of the answer as well. She is made to lie, and she is made to not appear too much in public. She eventually decides to just only go out in public when it's dawn and people are not quite awake yet. So she goes out when the sun is just coming up, and that's when she has a fresh air, a little bit of peace. And this act of not appearing in public is also like we talked before, is about, you know, saving the face of her family, trying not to remind people of her own existence. That is a kind of death, and that is a kind of a disappearance, but it's a repeated death, because what you make these women do is to repeatedly, you know, kill themselves in a way, to kill their own voices in order to save the, you know, save their families from societal damnation, I guess. Yeah, so this comes back in the title, How We Disappeared, because the word comes up so much, so many times during the writing of the novel, that I thought I couldn't let that go. And I thought this concept was just intrinsic to the whole idea of erasing or trying to erase trauma.
Yeah, this type of denialism is incredibly detrimental to trauma, to history, to seeking reparations, both on a personal level and a societal level. And definitely this idea of, you know, to disappear in English has this double meaning of something disappears by itself, but there's also the verb to disappear something, and I think that was really telling. This conversation has gone by so quickly, and I feel like we probably only have time for one last question, which is that this novel, for me, revels in ambiguity. There's a lot of ambiguity. It opens, the section that you read opens in on, you know, three versions of the same event, and it's up to us to determine which one's real. And this characteristic really permeates the entire, a lot of the narrative. As the, I suppose, the originator of the story, what do you hope people will take away from reading this beautiful novel?
That's a big question. Think about what people will take away from the novel, but I have, you know, I've been trying to guess what people would like to. And I think for me, it's a big thing to hope for, but I would like people to see Singapore as more than what it is now. It has its own history. It has its different kinds of people within the island. And you see people like Wang Di, who are living, you know, just on the edge, who are not completely enfolded into society, and people like Kevin as well, who are a little bit of outcast in their own circles. And by bringing these two people together, I wanted readers to be able to see what life was like from, you know, each of their perspectives. I mean, Kevin can easily access, and by having his perspective as well, I hoped that Wang Di's life would be a little bit more accessible, because of course it is Kevin in the end who ties it all together, who makes the story a little bit more accessible to the reader as well.
Definitely. And it is a beautiful work. So thank you for writing this text that counteracts the disappearance that's been, you know, foisted on these women who've lived through so much already. And, you know, really this is the kind of story that needs to be told so that we can rectify these sorts of hurtful events. Thank you again for speaking with me and speaking with the Melbourne Writers Festival. At this point, I would normally invite the audience to clap, but we can't hear them. So let's just imagine them clapping for you and this riveting conversation. A bit of a reminder for the audience that you can purchase the book via the Melbourne Writers Festival site with thanks to our bookshop partner, Readings. Thank you again, Jing, and thank you for speaking with us. Thank you for joining us. My name again is Adolfo. Have a good night.
Thank you. Thank you, Adolfo. Such a great reader. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this conversation. For more podcasts, sign up to our e-news at mwf.com.au.